This is Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
JBL Tour Pro 3 earbuds are for those who don't conform to the standard.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to get into some touchscreen technology, how about the smart charging case, clear sound? These are not standard things. You're only going to get them with the JBL Tour Pro 3, baby.
And I love the sound of JBL when it goes... These earbuds are packed with innovation because you can't stand out by following others.
Touchscreen smart charging case for one-touch control, instant EQ customization, true adaptive noise canceling, and the one-of-a-kind audio transmitter, which can plug and play with everything from game consoles to in-flight entertainment. What more could you want? First doesn't follow. Grab a pair at JBL.com.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The criminal case against Brian Koberger is over, technically. But the story is nowhere near done, because when a crime like this happens, especially one that devastates families the way the Idaho murders did, the criminal sentence is only one layer. Beneath that are all the questions about what could have been done to stop what took place. Who saw what? How many warning signs were quietly piling up long before anyone heard the name Brian Koberger on the national news? That's exactly what the Gonzalez family and potentially other families have now taken aim in another direction other than Brian Koberger. This time the aim is at Washington State University, WSU. Not local police, not the University of Idaho, not the county, WSU. The place that admitted him, employed him, supervised him, housed him, funded him, and watched him up close in the months leading to the murders. This isn't guesswork. This isn't a family looking for someone to blame. This is a family saying, you had complaints, you had patterns, you had warnings, and you had power. So the question becomes, did Washington State University use any of that power effectively, or did they watch a situation deteriorate and convince themselves it was just a difficult graduate student being awkward? It's a fair question. It's what I don't know that we know all of the answers to. But discovery is a great way to find out. And in a civil suit, you're going to have a lot of that. That means a lot more information is going to be coming out in the coming months about what Brian Koberger was like in greater detail to work with, to have as a employee, to have as a coworker, to have as a teacher, to have as a this and a that. We're going to see a lot of perspectives in the coming months. Are any of those perspectives going to be an actionable situation in which an entity, a university, and someone employed by said entity could have reasonably stepped forward and removed Brian Koberger from the position to which he was in, effectively getting him out of Dodge, thus preventing him from being around to commit the crime that he committed? That's what is going to be parsed out in this civil suit, or there'll be a big settlement and we'll never know any of it, which is probably far more likely. But it's an interesting question nonetheless. We're going to go through this, and I'd love to get your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Hit subscribe, please. We're trying to get to 100,000 before the end of the year, and we're getting close. We'll see if we can do it, but we do need your help, so please do hit subscribe on YouTube, and please let me know in the comments section your thoughts on this. Because when you dive into the records, the police interviews, the document dumps, the public reporting since sentencing, you see a pattern that's not subtle. In fact, it's one of the clearest escalating behavioral patterns we've seen in a true crime context tied to a university environment. Faculty and students describe Koberger as creepy, sexist, intimidating, odd, angry, and deeply troubling. One professor compared working with him to being around a predator. That's not an exaggeration. That language came from a faculty member who lived this in real time. That same professor reportedly warned colleagues that if Koberger finished his PhD, she fully expected to read about him in the future for stalking or abusing students. That's the kind of thing you only say when your gut is screaming at you that this person isn't just socially awkward, he's dangerous. But feelings are a funny thing. They're not always actionable, especially if it's just a feeling. And actions aren't always actionable if they don't cross a certain line. And the question is, did Koberger's ever cross certain lines? Let's stay grounded here because this is where speculation gets people in trouble. We're not claiming anyone predicted a quadruple homicide. Nobody did. But a lot of people at WSU predicted something. Something bad, something involving women, something involving power in violation of boundaries, something involving a man who clearly had no idea how to respect limits. And those complaints weren't vague. They were repeated reports of him blocking women in doorways so they couldn't leave offices, standing so close they felt trapped, hovering silently behind people as they worked, just staring. Following female staff or grad students to their cars, making unsolicited comments about their personal lives, going through someone's medicine cabinet during a group gathering, and then announcing medications to others. Allegations. Showing up in offices uninvited and refusing to leave, even when the conversation clearly ended. These weren't one-offs. They weren't misunderstandings. They were patterns. Documented by students, by faculty, by supervisors, multiple graduate students described him as spatially threatening, using a physical presence as a form of subtle dominance or control. Several women went to administrators not because he annoyed them, but because they felt unsafe. One office even had a tally board allegedly tracking his behavior, not as a joke, but because students wanted a record for how many times he crossed lines, made discriminatory comments, or disrupted the cohort. When you have that much documentation, you're not looking at random personality clashes. You're looking at an institution with its own little ecosystem where everyone knows who the problem person is, where everyone has a Koberger story, where women warn each other not to be alone with him, and where faculty are exhausted from holding meetings about the same student over and over. And yet he remained in the program. He stayed in his teaching position until he was eventually removed. Not for threatening women, but for being harsh in his grading and clashing with a professor. He remained in university housing. He continued his academic work. He continued interacting with the very people who were telling the university they didn't feel safe around him. Which is why the Gonzalez family is now saying, enough. In their tort claim, the formal step before filing a lawsuit, they argue that WSU had a duty to act on the complaints it received, not because anyone expected murder, but because federal law, state law, university policy, and basic duty of care require action when there are repeated allegations of harassment, stalking, or threatening behavior by an employee. And in this context, a graduate teaching assistant is an employee. He's not just a student. He's in a position of authority. He interacts with undergraduates. He holds office hours. He represents the school. And with that position comes responsibility. And with responsibility comes liability. The families point to the sheer volume of complaints, more than a dozen, according to the claim, multiple mandatory reporters aware of his conduct. HR and civil rights offices informed, meetings held, trainings mandated, supervisors intervening, students filing complaints, faculty warning about predator-like behavior. If even half of that is accurate and it aligns with the police interviews, then it raises one damning question. Why was he still there? That is the heart of the lawsuit. Not WSU should have known he was a murderer. That's not the claim. It's WSU knew he was a problem. WSU knew women felt unsafe. WSU knew there were red flags, and WSU had authority over him, and WSU didn't escalate appropriately. That's essentially what the lawsuit is saying. This is where the legal standards matter. Universities are responsible for creating a safe environment. They are responsible for addressing harassment and threatening behavior. They are responsible for responding to patterns, not just individual incidents. They are responsible for taking action when multiple women say the same thing. This man makes me feel unsafe. The counter argument from WSU will likely be predictable. That they followed procedure, that nothing rose to the level of expulsion, and they couldn't have foreseen a violent crime across state lines. That FERPA restricted what they could share, and that he wasn't on their campus when the crime occurred. Which are all true. And those laws are in place. And they may have followed everything to the letter of the law. Sometimes you just can't predict these people. And you can't just remove people for making you feel icky. Unfortunately, you can't. And Koberger may have walked right up to that line of icky into predatory. And knew just how to stay far enough over here where the idea of him being removed was not so real until it finally was. After many complaints, after a bit of time. Obviously, that is where it all ended up going, because they did remove him. But was it all too late? Should there be less patience in this process? The families aren't trying to blame WSU for the murders. They're trying to understand what kind of environment let him continue when so many people were waving red flags right in front of administrators. And honestly, whether or not the lawsuit succeeds, it's a valid question. One that goes far beyond this case. Because if the only time universities take decisive action is when someone makes a direct threat rather than when someone consistently intimidates, frightens, and harasses, then we're setting ourselves up for disaster. We've seen this in other tragedies. Institutions rarely act on patterns. They act on incidents. But predators don't present in incidents. They present in patterns. They test boundaries, they push, they escalate, and unfortunately, some institutions are better at protecting themselves than the people inside of them. This lawsuit, if it moves forward, is going to force transparency. Discovery means internal emails become public, HR complaints become public, meeting notes become public. If anyone minimized concerns, if anyone dismissed warnings, if anyone said, he's awkward, not dangerous, those decisions will be in black and white. And that's what the families want. And honestly, that's what the public deserves. This is not about blaming a university for four murders. This is about understanding whether an institution with knowledge of concerning behavior acted responsibly when women said over and over that this guy was not normal, not safe, not someone they wanted to be alone with. And if the answer ends up being that WSU didn't do enough, then maybe this lawsuit becomes the jolt universities need to take these patterns seriously, not after a tragedy, but before one. Because whether or not WSU is legally liable, the human question remains, how many warnings does it take before a system decides to protect the people in it? Right now, that number looks uncomfortably high. Tell me your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. That is where you will find us. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. So please do check that out. Hit subscribe wherever you're listening to us on the podcast platforms as well. We greatly, greatly appreciate it. Until next time, I am Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.